Heading to CBC? Make sure to stop by booth 1989 to chat with the Brewbound team, check out our live podcast recordings, and find out about Brewbound's upcoming events. Have news to submit ahead of the show? Head to brewbound.com/submitnews to let us know about your latest updates.
Welcome back to the Brewbound Podcast. I'm Justin Kendall, the editor of Brewbound, and I'm joined once again by BevNet editor-in-chief Jeff Kleinman. Jeff, I did not expect you to be back.
You know, after that bench-clearing brawl in the Super Bowl, me either.
I like how you're predicting the future.
I am in the future right now.
You are in the future. We are in the future. The future is season three? This is season three.
Yes.
I don't even know where I'm at, so.
You are in the Brewbound Podcast headquarters here in lovely Watertown, Massachusetts, a few days before the Super Bowl. See, we've played with time there just to mess with your listeners, most of whom are probably sobering up from their Super Bowl parties.
Let's face it, nobody's listening to this live. They don't care that, you know, we recorded this 3 days, 4 days before the Super Bowl. They're on their treadmill. They're driving to work. They're doing what normal people do when they listen to podcasts.
I thought you meant nobody alive is listening to this. I hope
somebody alive is listening, or at least FinTech does. I feel what we need is one of those two-minute Netflix intros where they like recap everything that you sort of missed in the last, what, it's been 3 months since we've recorded a podcast, or 2 months?
Yeah, absolutely. It's in fact been like the start of Succession with all these transactions taking place.
It really is. Even the day before Brewbound Live, when I'm trying to get my shit together and not have a panic attack, Constellation Brands ends up selling Ballast Point to little-known Kings and Convicts.
Yeah, which in fact is, you know, the subtitle for Succession.
Kings and Convicts?
Yes.
I think that's, I think that's every episode of Succession is Kings and Convicts.
Will you be a king? Will you be a convict?
I think I chose convict a long time ago.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's part of it's in the breeding, though.
Well, that's what they would tell you. They've got kings and convicts. The convicts are from Australia.
Yeah, they are.
That's how he described it to me, the co-founder of Kings and Convicts.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about the Murdoch family.
No, but yeah, that's also.
But yeah.
But we've seen a number of deals in the last 3 months. I think the last one we talked about was CBA finally getting acquired by AB and Whole. Molson Coors Beverage Company has a deal for Detroit's Atwater Brewery, and Constellation made a minority investment today, the day that we're recording this, in Press Premium Alcohol Seltzer.
Yeah, and there's also that purchase of the ready-to-drink spirits brand up in Canada.
Oh, yes. Neutral.
Yeah, good.
Well, Neutral was one of the main brands. It was Goodridge and Williams.
Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy. Like, you know, they say no and low is the future, but in the meantime, people just can't get enough.
Well, we get press releases all the time, and we've seen a number of companies' 2020 release calendars come in, and it's always low-calorie IPA. I'm launching a low-calorie IPA. So that seems to be one of the main trends of 2020 so far. We'll see if it has more legs than maybe Brut IPA.
How successful, you know, as someone coming in from the outside, I got to ask, I keep seeing these sessionable IPAs and these low ABV IPAs. How successful do the people in the brewing community feel like they're getting with these in terms of taste profile, in terms of sales?
Let's just look at Dogfish Head. They released Slightly Mighty. I think that's been one of their big plays last year. So they again seem to be ahead of the curve on some of these health and wellness trends, or at least, you know, low and sessionable drinks. One of them was Sequench, the sour ale, which, you know, Sam Caligioni described it as, he's 50 something now, you know, and he wants something that he can drink more of. And I'm 42 and I'm starting to feel that as I, you know, look at my stomach and in shame.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel like Sam Caligioni should drink more lower alcohol beers myself.
I want to go back and talk a little bit about Brewbound Live.
Because you want to go even further back in time than the Super Bowl?
A little bit. I want to rewind for a moment because I was super anxious about that. But I do want to say it's one of those things where it's like, you're scared to death of going on the roller coaster, and then you go on the roller coaster and you're like, I want to do it again. And probably one of the reasons that you folks have not gotten a podcast in the last like 2 months is I went into sort of a funk after that. You warned me.
I did.
That there would be a lull, and that lull hit me pretty hard. And yeah. This is me sort of coming back and saying, it's been hard to get back in the groove. This podcast has come back and I enjoy doing it. And this is me sort of putting myself back out there and saying, all right, we're back in the flow. So I just want to apologize for falling into that funk to all of our listeners and say, I'm excited to be back. I'm excited to be doing this. And I'm looking forward to season 3, I guess it is, of the Brewbound podcast.
Let me share a little bit of my wisdom, if I may, and a little bit of George Clinton's wisdom. I'll start with George. Never apologize for the funk.
That is great advice.
Thank you. Thank you. As for the rest of it, I'd say, you're not an extrovert by nature. I mean, we're talking into a microphone and you're worried that this microphone, it may have a negative opinion of you right now, but you do a wonderful job. And I think that what I loved seeing was you getting all this incredible feedback from the community that Brewbound tries to serve. And I think that live events are like that when they work. You know, it's why we go see live music or why we go to live sporting events. There's a communal vibe that goes beyond what's being presented or what's being taken in. And, you know, I think podcasting is a nice way of getting opinions and stories out there. But there's something about doing it live that's a lot of fun, and I'm glad you got a big taste of it.
Yeah, it was great. And I think one of my regrets was during my sort of welcome remarks, I expressed how much I love Brewbound, but I didn't sort of finish the thought that I wanted to, which was, I love this industry. This is such a privilege to be a part of this industry, to cover this industry, to, you know, meet the various people and see, you know, the highs and the lows and go through it. And it is really an honor and a privilege to be able to cover it. And I hope that comes through to everyone. It is definitely something that I probably didn't have to grow to love it, but I do love it.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that, and I hope you remain very tough on it as well.
Oh, as always.
Yeah,
I'm the toughest.
Tan their hides, man.
Yes.
No, Peter Tosh is the toughest. That's great. I got George Clinton. I got Peter Tosh, man.
Man,
who's
you're checking all your boxes.
Yeah, it's true. Well, they check mine.
Well, speaking of Brewbound Live, we announced our 2019 class of rising stars there, and one of them was Night Shift Brewing. The Everett, Massachusetts headquartered company fits that bill. It produced around 40,000 barrels of beer last year. They've been on an upward trajectory for some time now. But notice I didn't say craft brewery, because Night Shift is a craft brewery by the definition of the Brewers Association, But in the following conversation, Night Shift co-founder Rob Burns will explain why the company's guiding light moving forward is positioning itself as a beverage company. So here's Rob Burns. He's going to tell you more about it, and then we're going to come back and talk all about the interview. This is Justin Kindle for the Brewbound Podcast, and I'm here in the new Brewbound Podcast studio with Rob Burns, co-founder of Night Shift Brewing. Rob, it seems like every few weeks, Night Shift is announcing a new project. How are you keeping up with all of this? Because I'm having a hard time doing it myself.
Me too. We definitely have a lot of things going on, and we're fortunate in that case. But I think, you know, we've let our kind of creative wings go in many directions and set up the team so that we can expand in many kind of verticals. And one of the kind of driving forces is to turn Night Shift beyond just a beer company into a more of a beverage company. And that's kind of our guiding light right now.
Well, and that's something I wanted to talk to you about, because that seems to be a direction a lot of companies are going. I was at the Deschutes wholesaler meeting, and the name is Deschutes Brewery, but the CEO is on stage and he's saying, you know, we're a beverage company now. And I'm hearing that from more and more craft brewers. So I guess, what does being a beverage company mean to you?
Yeah. So for us, we kind of looked at it back in 2016 when we were kind of looking at trends and where people were shifting their choice of beverage. And we're like, if we're going to be here for the long haul, and like one of our goals is like, let's make sure we create a company that lasts 100 years. What would 50 years from now, and if we're just a craft brewery, would we still be able to survive? And so when we opened up the distributorship, it was a great way for us to start playing around with other beverages, starting with spirits and then wine, a bunch of non-alcoholic beverages, really helping us to learn those markets and dip our toes in without taking any capital kind of risk there, besides the inventory.
Seeing if everybody else could make it in those different segments, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And we learned a lot through that, and we continue to do that as well. We actually started this year, we got an import license, so we started importing wines from Europe, which is kind of, again, a little bit passion-driven, but another way for us to explore another beverage category. So we kind of think of it like, can we make a portfolio of beverages that we all have the same kind of quality, same kind of customer commitment, same kind of outward message, that are all branded Night Shift Brewing? And whether that be the hard seltzer or coffee or cider and things of that nature, could we do it with spirits? Could we do it with wine? Could we do it with other non-alcoholic beverages? And that's kind of like the path we've been set out for. And some of them are multi-year kind of projects that we're trying to explore and learn and take our time before just jumping straight into it. But we think there's a lot of room for opportunity.
It sounds like the playbook is wide open.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't seem like you guys have closed the door on really anything.
No, definitely. I think that's one of the things that I get excited about every morning when I wake up. You know, when we wrote our business plan originally, it was if we could, by year 10, sell 10,000 barrels of beer, we'd be wildly successful and be super happy and proud. We're at year 7. We're about to do 40,000 barrels of beer. We're making coffee. We're running a distribution company. We're running a restaurant. The plan has just kind of evolved and morphed as we learn more, as we get more excited about new ventures, and definitely driven also just by the people inside the organization.
So how do you juggle all that?
You know, I think one of the things that myself and the other founders have been really good at is letting go of control and trying to get the right people in the right seats so that we're setting ourselves up for smart people to kind of take the reins and with some level of guardrails and go. And that has been definitely one of our keys to success. We're not, you know, the overbearing founders that are worried about every detail of the recipe or how we're sourcing the ingredients. It's about giving people the long-term goal and letting them kind of be creative and go for it. So while everyone ends up reporting to me at the end of the day, I don't want or need to know everything that happens, and I don't ask to know everything.
You gotta wanna know like a lot though. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I definitely want to know if there's problems, and I want to know about the successes and where we can help, and definitely connecting the dots between the kind of different verticals of the business so that we're all moving the figurative boat in the same direction.
Malt Europe Malting Company is North American proud with premium grains from field to flavor. Our selections include base, specialty, and distillers malt varieties. Stop by our booth, 2143, at the Craft Brewers Conference in Vegas. Does your brewing software suck? We've heard it from thousands of brewers. Connect with Ollie today, and we'll buy out your current contract and hook you up with brewing software that doesn't suck. Visit booth 1685 at CBC or hit getollie.com/pod.
Well, what are some of the things that you decided that you could sort of pass off or delegate?
The guy who hired me first out of college when I was a computer science major, the offices were right around the corner from you guys in Watertown. He always taught me, like, train the people below you to take your job, and then you go look for a new job. which, at, you know, being 22 years old, I was like, I don't know what that means. Why would I want to lose my job? But that stuck around, and I think that's what we strive to do is, like, okay, the person who, if I'm in charge of purchasing, which at one point I was, I want to make sure that I start teaching how I made these purchasing decisions, how I got there, who to talk to, why to talk to, where to push back, how much inventory we want to have in any given time and things like that. And then once I can pass that off, I get to go figure out, well, what do I do with now, you know, 10 hours a week? And that has played out many, many times.
That's a good thing, yeah. Right? Having an extra 10 hours a week, it's got to be great, right?
Yeah.
But it's also, I guess, what are the challenges with that 10 hours? Like, I'm sure you get to spend a little more time with your family, but how else are you filling that?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's as simple as reading, whether it be reading industry news or reading other, like, Wall Street Journal or reading books. Sometimes it's going out there and talking to people, networking. I'm also the president of the Mass Brewers Guild, so that sometimes takes 10 hours a week of my time.
Or more.
Yeah, tomorrow I'll be at the Worcester Common for a beer fest for the guild all day. And I don't personally make any money on that, but it's something that I'm pretty passionate about. I really subscribe to that rising tide lifts all ships kind of mentality that this industry is known for. Yeah. And sometimes it's me coming back to the kind of leadership table and saying, I think we should do this. And they're like, Rob, no, we have too much to do already. Like, who are we going to manage that? Like, don't worry about that. Once my idea is a little more solidified, we'll figure out the playbook and go from there.
When you have so much growth and it's happening in such a short period of time, 7 years is not a long time for a beer company. How do you maintain the culture that you sort of built as you professionalize?
Yeah, that's an ongoing challenge. I mean, I tell it to our team members all the time, like, every 6 months, we're going to be a different company. And so you got to be up for that and along for the ride. So now that's actually part of, you know, the hiring process of, like, making sure people are comfortable with the ever evolving thing. We fix one thing and break three more, and that's hard, but also really fun. I love the puzzle solving part of it. Yeah, I mean, we started as with, like, everyone would be in one room and we were all kind of jack of all trades and we would know each other very well and we would spend all our time together. Like, we used to pay people so badly that we would buy deli meat and have lunch because we knew nobody could afford, like, a proper lunch. And so, like, we had a very family culture. I like to think we still do. Like, we're owned still by vast majority by the founders. We like to think it's about people and product before profits and create that. But it's definitely hard when you onboard new people to get them to buy into that kind of culture and value. And, you know, I think the hardest thing for us recently was opening our new brewery in Boston, Lovejoy Wharf, because that almost overnight doubled our headcount. And to get half the company to understand their new world and their new cultures and what's important, who we are and how we got here, you know, they're coming into this brand new, shiny, multi-million dollar brew pub environment and have no historical concept of, we used to buy deli meat because that's all we could afford.
So how do you get the buy-in?
I think it's just about being honest and open. I think it's about doing cross-department stuff. We have a lot of employees that have been here since the start. You know, when before we could even pay anybody a dollar, we had volunteers that would help bottle and stuff. And many of them became our original employees and are still with us. And so I think getting them just to talk to those people and see how far we've come, and even the ones that have only been with us 3 years, to be like, oh yeah, this, we didn't have this, we didn't have health insurance, we didn't have 401k, like, I think goes a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just when I see people at the end of their shift not run and go home and stick around for a beer, that just makes me super excited that, like, we're doing something right. We're creating an environment where people want to stay and not flee. And then,
so,
like,
you think you're getting it?
I think we're getting there. Yeah. We definitely, you know, sometimes make maybe poor choices in hiring where we didn't exactly line it up. But I think another current example is the Philadelphia brewery, when we have many people raise their hand saying, I don't know much about it other than we're doing it, and I want to move to Philadelphia to be a part of that. Like, that gives me, like, the tingly arm sensation of, like, what did we do that people are willing to get up and move to take on a whole new thing that even as founders we're still trying to define? I think those are the intangible kind of culture or atmosphere that we're creating that people are excited to partake in.
Well, it sounds like you've got people engaged. I'm just super curious, you know, how you talked about new employees, getting them to buy in. And now you've got, you know, older employees who have stuck around and been with you guys. How do you keep those employees who have been there from the start sort of still, I don't know, drinking the Kool-Aid, yeah, for lack of a better term, or drinking the whirlpool?
Yeah, I think it's, like, just taking care of people well. I think it's, again, transparency. I think it goes to paying people right. I mean, little things are just, like, unlimited vacation. I mean, we do 3 months paid maternity, paternity leave. Like, even in tech world, those are some things that are not standard. And, you know, people should live life and they shouldn't be tied to a desk or, you know, be stressed out about coming to work. I just think, like, that all kind of builds it. I don't think there's, like, one singular item. I think it's the combination of many items that really make it a special place to be.
You guys are still very much in growth mode and yeah, your arrow is pointing up. And that's not the case for a lot of brewers out there. You guys are largely bucking these trends. What sort of makes you confident that you guys can sort of go into a whole other state, essentially a new market, and make a go of it, you know, and not sort of have the fate of some of these other brewers who have taken on these projects, you know, and not fared as well?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly is a question that keeps us up at night and stressed. But I think when we look at it, the growth has continued to grow beyond our wildest dreams. We also really relied on contract brewing for a number of years to kind of prove that the demand for night shift was there without taking the CapEx on Everett. Our kind of main facility has been operating at 100% capacity for, we're going on year three of it. So we actually have been postponing this for a long time. And now it's getting to the point where we know we have this ton of volume that's actually made not in-house. And if we bring some of it back in and open up some new markets, there's room for us. I mean, we still have a very small distribution footprint. We've certainly taken the deep, not wide strategy really to heart. And it's like 98% of our beer is sold in Massachusetts. We're basically just in one state at a 40,000 barrel kind of rate. So not to go blindly into the frontier of, like, yeah, we're going to be a national brewery. That's not our aspiration in any sense. But to be a regional player is certainly what we're looking for. And I think if we can recreate Massachusetts at some level in Pennsylvania, that'll be enough to sustain that kind of that brewery there.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've always, I kind of alluded to a little bit, but, like, trying to look for growth opportunities without taking a ton of risk, and to kind of do that through a bunch of different products, whether it be, like, using contract brewing or, you know, using somebody else's services to help us, like, understand, is there a market for this before we dive full in?
Yeah. Well, it seems like you guys have been looking, well, I mean, like you said, you guys have been supplementing your production for a very long time. So it's obviously the demand is still there for your products, that you need this excess capacity. And I think you just put in a couple of giant tanks in Everett.
Yeah. Yeah. The Everett expansion is somewhat of a stopgap almost. It won't get us a ton of extra volume, but we knew Philadelphia was going to be a longer lead time. And, like, what were we going to do for 2020 if we if we didn't do it? Like, how do we grow, especially as we start to look at on new products? If we have to wait to Philadelphia, we'll miss out on that kind of consumer demand. And I think, like, for our perspective, we never set a barrel goal besides that initial business plan of, like, we need to hit 100,000 barrel brewery. Like, that's not on our radar. It's very much a consumer pull driven growth strategy than we got to push it into the market.
Yeah.
Which I think is a little bit of a different mindset than some of our competitors.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to get back to this notion of being a sort of a beverage company and what that means, because it is fascinating to sort of see this shift. And I guess when you are sort of making that, I don't know if it's a transition, or I wouldn't say it's a pivot, but when you're making that sort of distinction that, yes, you know, we're going to be a beverage company now, what I guess I'd like to know is it hard to get buy-in from people on your staff as far as there's a lot of pride in being like, I'm a brewer, I'm a craft brewer, you know, or this and that. So is it hard to sort of get the buy-in that we're going to be making seltzer now, or we're going to do cider, or we're going to start roasting our own coffee, or even jumping into the spirits or whatever?
Yeah, I can answer this in definitely a couple of different ways. I mean, seltzer is definitely a good example of, like, internal. We started looking at the seltzer category about 2 years ago, and we kicked it off by buying every seltzer product that was on the market, having nearly, I think we had like 80 employees or so at the time, and we had nearly every employee blindly taste every seltzer we could buy, collected all that data, and the feedback at the time was like, I don't want to drink these, and none of these are good. And I was like, okay, great feedback, but like, there's already something here. Like, we should at least try to understand how to make it and understand if we want to, how do we execute when the time feels right? But then in that time period from 2 years ago to now, everyone in my company drinks seltzer. Even brewers are drinking seltzer now. Like,
what do you sort of mark the shift to?
I think some of it goes back to just a return to just like, I want to drink something that's easy to drink. I mean, that's sort of what drove us to go down the light beer lot. Like, I just want something that's refreshing, that's enjoyable, that I can maybe have a couple, and I don't need to be punched in the mouth with double dry hopped, you know, 10% ABV type beer. Everyone talks about health and wellness. I think that's maybe a factor of it, but I think if you're drinking alcohol, you're not necessarily going for health in the first place. But, you know, there's something definitely to like that sort of session mentality of like, I want to have like four or five drinks over the course of a day because I'm barbecuing or, you know, out with friends or whatever, with still being in control. And I think those all feel that kind of need. So I think if we all are starting to drink it internally, why wouldn't we make it ourselves? That's how we got to Nightlight. Like, we were all drinking light beers in the summer because it was 100 degrees in the brewery and they were the most refreshing thing to drink. And then I was like, why don't we make it ourselves? And then it responded well. The consumers responded well to that concept. And now it's, you know, our year to date, it's our number one selling volume is Nightlight. And then when you add in Limelight, it's, you know, the two together are kind of our biggest force right now.
Wow. And so you get the feedback on hard seltzer, you know, I'm not drinking it. And then there's the shift in, I guess, acceptability or, you know, whatever we want to call it. So where do you go from there? You know, what was in the sort of decision making process from that moment?
So then it became like, well, how do we make this? And, you know, the brewers weren't too excited about it because, like you sort of mentioned, like it seemed anti-beer. But I think one of the ideas that resonated well with them was like, okay, if like a Pilsner or a lager is sort of the pinnacle of brewing because it takes so much finesse and skill and process, you know, what's one step further, like a base that literally tastes like nothing? We have to be like flawless in every part of our execution and quality to really make something that doesn't have a lot of character. And can we step up to that challenge? And that got like the brewing team excited. And then it took us a little while. We dumped a bunch of last year seltzers. We couldn't get it right. We weren't comfortable with the quality or the taste. We've always said, like, if we're going to create something, we got to create it better. And then starting like a little bit early this year, we felt comfortable with the base and then started testing flavors and having on draft and then testing the nutritional information, making sure we kind of felt comfortable so that we could lead up to a kind of a bigger scale launch. And while on the outside, it might seem like this happened really quick, it's like sort of been a 2-year internal process for us. So I feel like we take time to go both fast, but thorough.
Do you think that there is a niche for like a crafted seltzer? Can that sort of make a dent in the marketplace that's largely dominated by, you know, a very large craft brewer in Boston Beer Company? Then you've got Mark Anthony Brands doing White Claw. And then third is probably Bon & Viv, you know, Anheuser-Busch.
Yeah, I think there's certainly room for it. I think when we look at their kind of general process and our process, we feel like it's, again, a little bit more of a craft spin on it. It's not, most of those processes are creating a base that's like 14 to 20% alcohol and then watering it down. We're going the other way. We're starting with a 4% base and just adding flavoring. They're using yeast to ferment the beer, you know, usually in 7 to 7 days or so. We're actually using wine yeast and having about 3+ week fermentation cycle. So I think there's like a number of processes that I don't like the word necessarily premiumized, but like, I think it will translate well to the consumer of that this is a little bit more of a craft like beverage. And then I also would fall back on the success of like Nightlight, of being like, everyone thought, dude, you can never compete in the light beer category unless you have bucket loads of money and you can get TV ads and you'll never win. And we were like, I think we can win. We feel like there's room for a craft light lager, and it's doing exceptionally well for us. And so if we could do it with light beer, why couldn't we succeed against, you know, global players in the seltzer category? We also have that sort of advantage of kind of controlling our own distribution that really makes a big difference.
That's huge. How do you think it'll be accepted? There's this whole romanticism to craft, you know, like, you know, craft brewing, you know, I want to see the production process and that. You think that we'll get there with seltzer? Do you think that's something like a consumer will actually be like, yeah, I want to see how this is made?
I don't think so. I think one of like the interesting things is like, you know, in our sour beers, we buy like the super expensive, freshly pressed juices, which make beautiful beers that are just like so vibrant and like they look beautiful. They taste like real fruit because we're literally buying totes of fresh pressed juice from a local Massachusetts place. And then we look at Limelight and like that uses natural flavorings and people don't care. It just tastes good and they enjoy drinking it. Like, I think that's where seltzer comes in. Like at the end of the day, that when you're talking to a certain spectrum of the customer base, they don't care how like the sausage is made. They just want something that's fun to drink. And I think there's a lot of room for that. I mean, we've kicked around, should we create a seltzer only tap room and stuff like that idea.
Oh, wow. That is an idea.
I think there's a Colorado brewery that might've beat us to the punch, but you know, could we really embrace it and have it be a standalone thing? Maybe that's where they get to see how it's made.
I was going to say, where did you land on that? Are we going to see like the night shift seltzer emporium? Or?
Yeah. For one of our beverages, coffee, we are looking to do standalone coffee shops. So that brand has its own kind of like legs and homes and own life cycle. But we're not sure on the seltzer yet. Well, I think we'll wait and see how this next year unfolds with seltzer.
Night shift seltzeria.
Yeah.
I don't even know what you'd call it. Yeah. When you're looking to do some of these Beyond Beer products, so far, I mean, with the coffee at least, you guys have branded it as a night shift product. Are you sort of looking at the same thing with seltzer?
Yeah. We're looking to keep them all under one brand, which is, I think, it seems to be a little bit different than everyone else is kind of thinking of in the market. We're kind of viewing it, it's a branded house and all the products have the same logo, the same name, and not a house of many brands. Mm-hmm. We think that the Owl has a good marketplace value, you know, not like we can compare it to the Nike Swoosh, but that's light years ahead of us. But like the similar concept, like Nike Swoosh, if you're buying golf or running clothes, it's all the same Swoosh. Everyone knows that stands for something. Let's have the Owl kind of stand for that. And I'm in love with the idea of like going around a store and you're going down different aisles and seeing owls in different places. Each product has to be on the same level, because if one of them is worse quality or worse packaging, we're going to degrade the overall owl. So like that sets us up to uphold a really high standard internally of like what we're putting out there has to be at the same level as the beer started at. Otherwise we're going to bring the beer. We're going to start like stepping down the stairs instead of trying to elevate it.
You had mentioned, you know, you're not necessarily looking to be a national player, but being regional is sort of where you guys are feeling comfortable. Was that always what you guys had set out to do, or did that sort of vision of what Night Shift would eventually look like evolve?
Yeah, we've never had kind of that national ambitions. It was much more like, let's make sure the owl is everywhere in Massachusetts was sort of the initial premise. And whatever that means, we don't know, but let's explore that. And now with the Philadelphia brewery on the horizon, like that gives us a sort of a little bookend of kind of like the East Coast as maybe potential runway. But the plan has evolved so many times over the years that like it's again kind of going to be like, where does the road take us? With no necessarily like need to push. I mean, I think that's one of the things that we love about staying independent and only having a small amount of friends and family be our original investors. Like we don't have to do anything. We're not trying to get anybody a return on their capital. Like we're not setting this thing up to sell. Like we're just going to do whatever makes sense. And if at some point, like we're exhausted from running 10 different business lines, like we'll just stop, not stop the business, but like stop expanding it. And that can be okay. I feel like that frees us up a little bit to let's let it go where it goes.
You guys aren't exhausted yet. I'm exhausted thinking about everything you guys got to take care of.
We're definitely tired. I have an 8-month-old at home that also wakes me up in the middle of the night. So that doesn't help either. But again, I think it's just trying to be good management of time and resources and setting that up for success.
Yeah. Well, this has been awesome. Any thoughts that you'd like to sort of leave our listeners with?
Oh, man.
Advice that you'd throw out for somebody that wants to, you know, build not just a brewery at this point, but something that has a ubiquitous logo that's in, you know, every section of the grocery store.
I give it way too much free advice all the time. My wife is like, you got to start charging people. You're giving away too many ideas. But I love that. So, you know, people should feel comfortable reaching out. I always respond via email or phone calls or whatever. I mean, I think if for new breweries that I'm talking to, I always make sure like that they've done their homework. I think it's amazing to me that how many existing breweries still don't understand the regulatory environment, still don't understand what they can and can't do. If you didn't read the alcohol law like 100 times in your state and then at the federal level, like you're already at a disadvantage. If you didn't understand like the economics, like if you don't understand basic financial statements and COGS and things like that, like you're going to be in trouble. And I think too, just generally just a taproom only model is not as glamorous as I think maybe it's been portrayed in the industry. And so think hard about, can you make that sustainable?
Well, and just from our conversation here, I sort of wonder, you know, you talk about diversifying into all these different things. It's like, can you make it as just a craft brewer now? Do you have to, you know, sort of be a beverage company and looking beyond, you know, your own four walls?
I think it's really tough to make it as just a taproom only beer company. I mean, our Everett taproom is down for second year in a row. That's the only like part of our business that's not really growing.
That's surprising.
Yeah. And there's a, you know, we have a multitude of things that we think are related to that. But one of the very obvious things is like when we go to book private events for that space, if we don't have wine, spirits, or gluten-free option, we lose those. And in Massachusetts, it's not easy to have those options. So again, going to the seltzer, one of the really pushes for the team was like, if we have this, we have a gluten-free option and we have a non-beer option that we can book private events with. Like that will solve a taproom only need. And then of course, like, okay, well, it actually has probably bigger legs much further than that. But I mean, we just lost out on a $50,000 private event. They wanted to book the whole taproom for like 12 hours. And it was like, if you don't have wine, we're not coming. And we're like, we legally cannot provide you with wine. But I would love to host you and you know, sell a $50,000 event.
Wow.
So I don't know how somebody smaller can totally thrive if they're not thinking about other types of beverages or other ways to get people in.
Yeah. Well, this has been awesome, Rob. I will be eagerly awaiting the announcement of Night Shift's winery and distillery. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
All right, that was our interview with Rob Burns. Jeff, Rob's talking a lot about becoming a beverage company. You've done more so on the non-alcoholic side. What are your thoughts on how these beer companies that are positioning themselves as beverage companies, what's your thoughts on how they're going to be able to compete in these different spaces?
It's interesting because we talked about Deschutes last year, looking at that sort of total beverage idea, and even the giant non-alc strategics are still struggling with whether they're total beverage or just soda companies. So everyone has this conception of being total beverage. I think what's interesting here is you see a pretty small scale operation trying to build tightly on its infrastructure. So, you know, if you can be a local one-stop shop, that's great. You know, if you can grab a little bit of the Eastern Seaboard, that's great. By the way, I think the Owl is just a hootenanny of a brand.
I think it's great marketing.
Yeah. I mean, you can't beat an Owl, because if you do, the game warden will be very upset with you. You can't beat an Owl as like a brand symbol. And as we've said in the past, I think Night Shift has really great instincts when it comes to providing both consumer and sort of customer service. You know, everything from, we're not just going to provide our craft beer, we're going to provide craft beer to that sector of restaurant or liquor store that serves the craft beer consumer. And they've managed to create throughput for so many brands in this area. The need for an upscale coffee brand is ubiquitous in accounts. So being able to provide that kind of thing is also a really good idea. Now, it's hard to get into mixers and NAs and, you know, things like that. And yet, having trucks is a good thing.
That's the thing I keep coming back to. They have the trucks. Yeah. They have the space. Why not try it? We talked a lot about authentic alternatives at Brewbound Live. Tommy Arthur sort of, I don't know if he coined that phrase, but that was part of his speech, and talking about how everybody has to find that thing that's going to work for them beyond what they're doing, as we've seen everything sort of slow down and the competition get even hotter. And Night Shift is doing a lot of different things that I think they're, you know, it's going to help sort of fortify their business.
I agree. I think the fact that they're doing two things at the same time is kind of nice too. Like, look, getting a light beer out there really speaks to them as a brewery, whereas the seltzers is kind of like customer service almost. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, man, I was at a theater performance last night, a theatrical performance of Mean Girls, and they sold a lot of seltzer and they sold a lot of champagne. Of course, it was Wednesday, and on Wednesdays they all wear pink at these performances, apparently.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Did you wear pink?
I didn't know it either. My daughter didn't tell me to do it, but you know. look, the point is, seltzer's growing. People are seeing a need for light beer. People are dropping calories left and right. But I still worry for this industry whether it cuts too far against the grain of the product type that built it. And just as someone who really believes in the spear tip approach to brand building, I worry that too many brands pivot with fingers in the wind to try and survive what is essentially right now a slowdown in growth, not even a pullback, but a slowdown in the growth rate. But to further the point on night shift, they've been committed from a very early time to being sort of a multi-service kind of company. And that's, I think, an offensive business plan rather than a repositioning and a pullback in the face of headwinds. And I think there's a very different kind of approach there. It's a nice thing, particularly if you hit an economic pullback, it's nice to have some actual things to get loans with, as opposed to just sort of diluting yourself as a entity to get capital in.
Yeah. One thing else that I'd like to touch on is the big bet in Philadelphia. And when you're pushing as much volume as they are, and they do contract produce at Isle Brewers Guild, $10 million on a facility in Philadelphia, it sounds like a lot of money to me. It is a lot of money. It is not without risk, but it does seem like they have the volume and the need. And if they can make that work, I think that's sort of a game changer for that business.
Hey, it's a big market. And Philly's a big city, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can, and again, if you can bring in your trucks, your merchandising, and your beer into that market, it's ground game.
Mm-hmm. Well, like we talked about, it's a strong brand. Will it play in Philadelphia? I think it will. Two of the owners have personal ties to that area. Rob even mentioned the possibility of him moving there potentially in the future. So it's not so much of a stretch, you know?
Hell, man, what's the mascot for Temple?
An owl.
Yeah, there you go. Fear the owl.
On that note, that is our episode for this week. We are available on pretty much any platform you want us to be available. If you like the show, we'd love a review. If you didn't, send me an email at podcast@brewbound.com. That's podcast@brewbound.com. And send me an email, too, if you want to be featured. I'm going to be on the road, so I'm going to hopefully record some podcasts here with some folks. So if we can link up, let's do it. Thanks to our audio team. Thanks to Rob Burns. And thanks to all of you for listening. Catch us next week for episode 2. Until then, cheers.
Cheers.